Herzlich willkommen zu Saatkorn, deinem Podcast mit Inspiration für eine bessere Arbeitswelt. Hello everybody and welcome to Saatkorn. Today I have a guest here on the show who was here before, and some of you will know him because he was also at the Embrace Festival last year. He's a great guy and he just has his new book out. It's pretty fresh actually. It's called Outlearn. We'll talk about this later. But I say welcome to Pascal Finet. Great to have you back here on the Saatkorn show.
Gero, it's always amazing to be on your podcast, at your events. I always learn something new from you, so I'm very, very excited to be here.
To give the listeners who don't know you some background, you have spent 2 decades at the intersection of technology leadership and organizational change at companies such as eBay or Mozilla Labs, also Google. And now you're teaching executives at business schools around the world, and you advise companies through Radical, the company you founded. And actually, we got to know each other on such an assignment for Bertelsmann. So then I felt like, wow, this is pretty great what this guy does. And I invited you to the festival. And now we're talking here about the new book, Outlearn. So how did the idea come up for this new book?
It's actually a funny story. So I wrote my first book, Disrupt Disruption, which really deals with this idea of how do we look at disruption differently and how do we make it very tangible for business leaders. And after that book, we dug much deeper into the question which we got from participants of our programs like you, who came to us and said, okay, we get this disruption stuff. What does this actually mean for us as a leader? And what does it mean for the organizations we run and how we run them? So we started digging into this topic, and it occurred to me that when you look at today's environment, which is incredibly uncertain, it's much more volatile, it changes so fast, it's really turbulent, that companies typically, at best, become maybe resilient. That's the term you hear a lot. And it struck me that when you look at nature, nature doesn't necessarily build resilient systems. They are resilient, but they actually typically grow when they're exposed to stressors. The simplest example is you go to the gym, you deliberately destroy your body, right? Like you build up like sore muscles to then essentially like have your body rebuild those muscles and become stronger. So in organizations, we didn't do that. So that got me thinking about what does it actually mean to build an organization for turbulence? And I started fleshing this out as ideas, and we tested them with our clients. And then I started putting this into an outline and a structure. And I was like, I'm going to write this book about it. And then as I started doing this, and I literally had like, I don't know, 3-4 chapters written, the outline done, I realized this book is going to be my opus magnus. It's going to be like 600 pages, like this really big book, because there's so much to talk about. And then I did the thing which, you know, like I advise everybody to do. It's still really hard for me personally to do, because I took this idea and I brought it to people like you, executives, and said like, hey, we're going to write this book. What do you think? And they all said that it's a great idea, but quite frankly, I don't have time to read 600 pages, let alone implement 600 pages. So that got us into this idea that, you know what, we're going to break out the individual components of this book and turn them into field guides, little 150, 200 pages books you can read on a flight, cheaper than a lunch. And they really teach you something about how do you do this particular thing. And the first book in this series is Outlearn, which is really about how do you learn faster than the world can change.
The topic speed is so important at this point, especially at this point in time, due to the super fast hyperspeed development of technology, AI. I mean, that's a big topic at the moment. And I had a discussion with our chief innovation officer, and he said to me, well, actually, speed is key. It's so much key that He really thinks a big corporation such as Bertelsmann is way, way, way too slow. Even if we start to be fast, we are still way slower than if you do it just alone, without any compliance, any regulation. And this becomes really a big, big issue, also for me as a CEO. So how can I keep someone who really says speed is key and we have to move forward? And this topic, the art of learning faster than the world can change, I think is on everybody's table right now, and it's in one of the top priorities. So that's a great idea to start there. But how did you structure this first book?
So first of all, 100% agree. I think in this environment we are living in today, one of the only, if not the only variable you can control as a leader and as a company is your speed of adaption. Like how fast you can actually move. I want to just make sure one thing saying about these big corporations, as you mentioned, I do believe that there is exceptions to this. If you run a nuclear power plant, you don't want to run the power plant with the rules of a free jazz band. This is like not a good idea. Please don't do that. So there is moments for us where we should actually, even in today's environment, should slow down. But overall, I absolutely agree with you in terms of the importance of speed and the lack thereof in many larger and even smaller organizations. Really, the way we structure this book, the journey we're taking you on, is we start thinking about and exploring what it means to live in a turbulent world. Really, like this idea is that you have to stop predicting the world like a cartographer, where you try to map out the world and really think more like a bat. So when a bat flies through utter darkness, it sends out these sonar pings, thousands in a minute. And it essentially builds an understanding of what the environment looks like in front of it, live, in real time. And there's companies which do this really, really well. Then once you understand that, you get into this interesting problem that if you think about failure, because experimentation, trying things out, always comes with trying something and you will fail, like no doubt. There is a really fascinating challenge around this, like failure for me is physics and not morality. So the challenge is that your amygdala, the oldest part of your brain, really fights you. It does not want you to fail because it is hardwired into us to survive. And when you look at the math, you realize also, when it comes to failure, there's only certain kinds of failure which compound into learning. Most don't. So it's this really interesting art of finding the right level of failure and overriding your amygdala to not condemn it, to not be, you know, be judgmental about it. And then we have a whole bunch of stuff we can talk about, but the core idea here is that we have this learning loop. We call it DCLA, stands for Detect, Contain, Learn, Adapt. Four steps, one loop. If you run this really fast, so you go from detect the insight you got from your experiment, you contain the blast radius, so you make sure that you're not like destroying your company while you're doing so. You learn from it, which is really important, and then you adapt and you move on. If you can run this loop faster and faster, you will be successful in this environment. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff we can get into.
All right. It sounds so easy. Obviously, that's the right way to go. Yeah, fail fast, learn from your experience, and then move on from there. That's learning at speed, just with different wording. But what I face, also being a CEO here in Germany, where we have a lot of laws and surrounding, if I take your bad example, is I could move forward and really try to go with my senses and really experiment. But then the way where I'm allowed to fly is pretty much restricted. And that's the big issue I face at the moment. Do you have some idea regarding this as well?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think rules and regulation for sure is an inhibitor to moving fast. And they are here for a good reason. Like if you think about in the US, we've got this medical compliance, HIPAA compliance, which basically means like your private information, particularly in the medical field, needs to be protected under specific ways. You have similar things in Europe around PII, personal identifiable information. And I think that's right. Like there is a reason why you want this. You don't want to, you know, like, as we're currently seeing with the wipe coding craziness, you know, like kiddos like building like an app in an afternoon and then suddenly like all of your customer data is exposed on the internet. You don't want that for sure. I do believe though that, and I learned this interestingly from pharma, so big pharma companies which operate in an extremely regulated environment.
Regulated, yes.
They keep telling me that at least in pockets, they can be insanely innovative by just basically understanding where are the guidelines, like where are the rails, and then still within those rails moving very, very fast by really very deliberately looking at the whole process chain and saying which of these parts can't be moved fast and in which other parts can be moved really fast. So Big Pharma is a good example. The identification of new targets, as in molecules, has been sped up by AI by factor, I don't know, 100, by factor 1,000. So they're moving way faster than they could ever before. They still need to do clinical trials because that's just the way it has to be. But my invitation is always, it is so easy to like kind of lean back and like throw the hands up, your hands up in the air and say like, oh, we're regulated, we can't do this. I'm like, yeah, sure. But also just like take a very, very careful look at all of your like all of your value chain, all of your processes, and ask yourself where can we actually push on the envelope. And very often you'll find many, many areas where you can actually do things much faster and can experiment much more freely than you might think.
I like your approach here, because obviously regulation is quite often just the excuse to not do anything, yeah, and not being inventive and stuff like that. So it's great that you give this positive outlook and framing here. You mention also in the book the two engines model. What's that?
So we call this the sampling engine, and we borrowed this from. There's a gentleman who wrote a book on anti-fragility, Nassim Taleb. This book came out 10, 15 years ago. And he's got this notion around what he calls the barbell strategy. So he's basically saying, if you look at a company and it maps one-on-one to what we are seeing with organizations, when you look at strategic bets about the future, he says, there is essentially you run two engines. One is your execution engine. This is your conservative engine. You know the business and you know it, you know, generates cash flow, it generates profits. You want to spend a good chunk, 90% of your energy on this engine. And then there's on the far end of that is what we like to call the sampling engine. This is where you fly the bat, where you try things out. You're really aggressive. This is probably 10% of your effort. If you are successful there, if and when you're successful there, the payoff is astronomical. This is your 100x returns. The challenge with this bubble strategy is that there is this kind of thing in the middle where you're not really taking big risks, but also if you get it right, the payoff isn't actually that great. And what I find companies tend to do is execution engine, every company is good, otherwise you wouldn't exist. The sampling engine thing, a lot of companies are not aggressive enough there. I think a lot of companies are not actually swinging for the fences. What they're doing is they're trying to place bets which are a little bit better than, you like, you create a product which is a little bit better than the old one. Like you, I don't know, like create a mobile, back in the day, like a mobile app for your thing. And it's like, yeah, sure, like do it, but the payoff isn't that great. So really swing for the fences. So the idea is that you need to build these two engines and they operate so differently. And the mentality around them, the mindset, the way people think about those are so different that very often you have to separate them. Very often you can't have executives like jumping between those because it's just really confusing. You're sitting in one meeting and it's about efficiency and effectiveness and how do you squeeze little margin gains out of whatever you're doing. And then you need to go like across the floor. And the only question you should ask your team is, what did we learn today? right? Because it's all about this, like the learning cycle, the speed of learning. And it's really hard for companies to manage. It's doable though. But it typically requires you to like actually separate those out and be very clear and deliberate about those.
In terms of the book you wrote before, Disrupt Disruption, I'm a big mm-hmm. fan of this book, as you might know. And what I really liked about the book is that it contained a lot of ideas that I could use in my practical work mm-hmm. experience. So it's, yeah, on the one hand, it made me think. On the other hand, it made me work, which I really mm-hmm. liked. And what about this new book? Is it the same idea?
Yeah. It's even worse. No, it's even better. So what we've done with this book is, again, like as I mentioned, we took this magnum opus, we basically broke it down into individual little books. So these books are really meant as like a practitioner's guide. Like the idea I had with this book is I want you to mark it up. I want you to like, you know, like bend pages to like put stickies in there, whatever. Each chapter, each part ends with a short summary, a too long didn't read, as well as a Monday morning actionable. So literally it tells you like, hey, here's a thing you can try out on Monday morning. And just to like whet your appetite of like, how do these Monday morning things look like? You know, one I love is, for example, just like your, look at your current portfolio. We call this the audit approach. So you look at your current portfolio and you look at every project you ran, which cost you more than, let's say, I don't know, whatever it is, $100,000. And ask yourself, did we actually run a super cheap $100 or $1,000 test on this thing? And if you haven't, you should actually pause the project because you're making decisions and assumptions based on something you might not actually really understand or know. And really go back to, okay, how do we run a very small, cheap experiment to figure out if we're even on the right trajectory here? Super easy. You can literally do this Monday morning. And yeah, so the whole book is chock full of that stuff.
I totally like that approach. We just started a new initiative dedicated to the public sector. And obviously, we did an outline how the whole initiative could look like. But then we decided not to do everything right away, but to start with just one little tiny thing, a test with a podcast. So mm-hmm. we started a podcast with like 2 or 3 episodes and checked, do the people like it? Is it interesting for them? If so, we could start a series of a webinar and we could have an event later on. And so perhaps that's a practical example how to yep. move in that direction. Yeah,
that's exactly what we talk about. We talk about this idea of the coat hanger test. So there's a story. When you read the book, you will get this. There's a story about a coat hanger, which goes all the way back to Google X. But this idea of like, instead of debating something for 6 months and building this master plan, which is all built on conjecture, all built on we believe something about the world, we actually don't know. Again, like my point is like, pick something. Build the worst, simplest version of it you can, like your podcast, right? It takes you not a lot of time, like 2 episodes, 3 episodes, and you actually know if it works. So it's perfect. It's a perfect example.
There's one thing if you talk about speed but also failure. In certain surroundings, obviously, it's always difficult to talk about failure. Yeah, mm-hmm. if you're on the sea level, failure obviously is not a nice thing. Yeah, to just say it very straight. But then again, failure with the right approach obviously makes you better. So instead of embracing failure, what would be your suggestion to think about this thing yeah. called failure?
Totally. Well, two things. One is nobody likes to fail. Like, absolutely. Like, again, like this is your amygdala. There's this incredible experiment which was done in the 80s where you put people in an fMRI scanner. So you scan their brain activity and you have them imagine a situation where they play a game of ball tossing. So they toss balls back and front. And then at one point, the person is instructed to imagine they don't get the ball passed. So they kind of like exclude it from the group. And what they found is that the part in your in your brain, which lights up, is the exact same part as you when you feel physical pain. You literally feel physical pain when you're excluded from the group. The challenge is that failure makes you feel that way. You feel you're excluded. You're not part of the group anymore, right? So there's a very good reason why we don't like failure. So to overcome this, two things. One is really focus on the learning. So the other experiment which has been done is if you have someone recall learning in a failure. So instead of asking like you fail, you know, like reimagine this, but you just literally ask, okay, great. What's the data? What did we learn? Like, and that's your only question. And, you know, here's an interesting insight, even for a leader. When someone comes to you and says like, hey, I tried this, I failed. Instead of saying like, what went wrong? Right. Or like, you know, oh my God.
What did you learn? Whatever.
Yeah. Instead, just go and say, okay, great. What does the data say and what did we learn?
Right. Okay.
Like you immediately unlock this, like this physical like feeling goes away. There's an acronym. We didn't come up with this, but there's an acronym to use fail as your first attempt in learning, which kind of like, it's a little cheesy, but I kind of like. The other thing which I find is important to understand, particularly as an executive, is failing when it costs you a lot of money is not good. Failing when it's cheap is amazing because that's how you learn. There's a, literally, you can take this whole book and condense it down to one line. And that one line is that the speed of learning is inversely proportional to the cost of failure. Mm-hmm. If failure is expensive, you learn slowly. If it's cheap, you learn fast. So make failing really fast. And that requires you to do what you did, right? Two episodes of a podcast cost you kind of nothing. And you know.
Yeah, exactly. And for all the people who are now really curious regarding the book, well, you can meet Pascal in June on the Embrace Festival. And obviously, he'll have some books there. He might sign them as well for you.
Totally.
It could happen. But even the better thing is we have two sessions planned. One is exclusive, but one is also open. And actually, it will be more or less opening a session of the whole festival. It comes right after my opening keynote, and it's called the Turbulence Lab. And obviously, it has to do with the content we just discussed. So perhaps you can give a rough outline what to expect in your session.
Absolutely. So when you and I talked about this session and the sheer fact that I come back, which typically my recommendation for any festival organizer is never ever bring someone back on the keynote, like on a keynote stage, right? So we said, let's not talk about content anymore. Let's get really deep into these ideas of this, of the book, of learning fast. So what we're going to do is we're going to do an experiment, and we might fail, but we're going to do an experiment with every single person in the audience where we will actually have you learn about the DCLL loop a little bit more, and B, apply it to your business in a really fun, high energy, maybe a little stressful, at least for a moment, format. So we'll have a ton of fun together. Highly recommend coming to the Embrace Festival. Also just want to note this, something like Embrace, and I'm not paid to say this, something like Embrace in today's world, which is so turbulent, so unpredictable, so fast moving, something like Embrace is so incredibly important because it is the place where you can unlock a lot of learning and you supercharge. You literally got like, you get like a year's worth of learning in, 2 days of conference. So do yourself a favor, show up.
Thank you for this nice wording, this nice framing. And actually, you're the big exception because my own rule is not to have the same speakers there for a second time, at least not in the next year. But since we do something different and since I know that you have a very broad spectrum to talk about and to really get the people moving, I feel this is really the right thing to do. So it's an exception, but I'm really totally looking forward to it. All right. Zartkorn has the claim inspiration for a better working world. And although you already said so many inspirational things, I know that you're a guy who goes with very wide open eyes through his life. And is there something that inspired you lately? It must not necessarily have to do with the working world. It could be also something else, perhaps something from your climbing experience. I don't know.
There's so much which inspires me. I give you two short ones. One is one of my climbing partners is this absolute legend here. I'm in Boulder, Colorado, which is like one of the climbing meccas in the world. It's this guy, Charlie. He's an absolute legend. He's been climbing for 45 years. He's in his late 60s now. He's got like his hips are destroyed. His knees are destroyed. He literally hobbles up to the crag when we go climbing. And then he climbs circles around me. So I just leave this as a piece of like image for everybody to recall. The other thing I just want to mention this is I've been thinking about this a lot recently, which is this notion around what does this environment, this world actually mean for our kids and the young people entering the workforce today? And quite frankly, I would be terrified if I were to leave college this year and needed to find a job in an environment which is so fast moving and this whole AI stuff. And I don't know how this is in Europe, but in the US, we already see entry-level positions being eliminated, which is a disaster. And it really made me think about what do we actually teach kids? And I got pretty deeply involved locally here with our local Waldorf school. So you might be familiar with Waldorf and Montessori schools.
The concept is prominent in Germany as well.
Yeah, right. So like this holistic learning, yes, like problem-based learning. And looking at this, I fundamentally believe it's the future. It has to be the future. Like the, you know, I grew up in Germany. I learned classic Gymnasium, you know, like rote repetition and learning. Like it doesn't matter if you understand what happened in history. All you need to know is when something happened so you can put it in the test. And I really fundamentally believe like, and I think this is not just true for our kids and education, but also for our companies. We really need to get away from like thinking about linear processes and rote repetition and get into like a much more holistic perspective. And here's the most important thing. When it comes to AI, for me, AI is an answer machine. It gives you answers. But humans have these unique capabilities to ask questions. And I think we, in business, we really have to get better at asking better questions about our business, our customers, our products. And when we do that, then AI becomes an incredible enabler.
I totally like that, this idea of asking more instead of having the answer right in your in your own head. Okay, great. Thank you so much that you took time for ZartCon again. I wish you all the success with the book and great feedback, and looking forward to meeting you on June 10 on the Embrace Festival.
Absolutely. Gero, thank you so much for having me.
So, das war diese ZartCon-Podcast-Episode. Ich hoffe, die hat Spaß gemacht und sie hat dir gefallen. Bevor ich jetzt hier rausgehe, noch ein kleiner Tipp für dich. Abonniere doch kostenlos meinen ZartCon-Newsletter. Dann gibt's jeden Sonntag alle Podcasts, alle News, alle Artikel, alle Verlosungen, alles, was ich auf ZartCon so mache, gratis in dein Mail-Postfach und du hast bequem alles an einem Ort und verpasst nichts mehr. Das Ganze kostet, wie gesagt, nichts. Den Link zum Abo gibt's in den Shownotes. Würde mich freuen, wenn wir uns da wieder treffen. Ganz lieben Dank und bis bald. Ciao.